From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton. The closure of parks, pools, and other community centers has been one of the ongoing features of tight government budgets in our area. Some surprising areas have been hit, including popular McKinley Park in East Sacramento, one of Sacramento's best-off areas. But East Sac residents pulled together to fund the maintenance and manage McKinley Park's Clooney Clubhouse, and they are here this morning to tell us how they did it. They may also have some ideas to share for other hard-hit areas and how they might do the same thing. Joining me this morning are Lisa Schmidt and Cecily Hastings of East Sacramento. They are co-founders of Friends of East Sac. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What was threatened in McKinley Park?
The closure of the community center was actually scheduled for July of last year as part of the city's budget for the year, fiscal year, starting in July. And they were, because they had existing rentals commitments, they were making kind of the effective date of the closure sometime, I think, in September. And so that, but the council, in closing the centers, taking the funding away from them, asked the Parks Department to go out into the community and try to find nonprofit partners that they could, that would be willing to take over these centers. And that's the first time that Lisa and I heard of it.
And that's Cecily Hastings from the Friends of ESAC. This was sort of done in degrees, right? I mean, weren't the pools closed first and then some of the community centers?
Well, there's been kind of a rollout of of cut in services in general. Not only a number of the pools had been closed in recent years, I even believe, and the cut back in maintenance of McKinley Park, cut back in maintenance of the McKinley Park Rose Garden, cut back in the maintenance and the care of the community centers. And it's not that the city wanted to destroy all this. They just were faced with the fiscal reality of being able to have to not have enough funds to deliver the kind of service that they had to maintain all these facilities and assets in the neighborhood.
Right. In fact, you did a piece in Inside the City, one of your newspapers, and it was striking to me how expensive it is to run a city park, particularly one with a lot of different assets in it.
Absolutely. And, it's for instance, this is the one example that I've been told, and Mr. Combs here can confirm this. But, 5 years ago, there were two people working full time caring for the Rose Garden in McKinley Park. Now, two people work full time to maintain like six or seven parks, including all of McKinley Park.
Wow.
So, I mean, you just do the math on that. You can picture that situation. You can kind of see what the kind of tight budgets they've been faced with.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let's bring Jim Combs into it. He's director of the Parks and Recreation in Sacramento, in the city of Sacramento. What kind of cuts have you seen? And you've been charged with executing all of this. What's the overall contours of the loss of money for parks in particular?
Good morning, David, and good morning, folks. It's been pretty severe. We started our downturn 4 years ago. This is our fifth year of declines in our budgets for the city. And the Department of Parks and Recreation has actually been one of the hardest hit departments in the city. And we've lost over 50% of our general funds and over 50% of our staffing. We used to have two, three-person crews on our maintenance, for example, that would go out and we could maintain our parks, pick up trash daily, mow once a week, really stay on top of things, clean the bathrooms daily. Now we're down, over half of our crews are one-person crews. So they're running through the parks. We're lucky if we can pick up trash a couple times a week. We don't pick them up in every park. We pick up the trash where we know that there's heavily used parks. We mow about once every 14 days. We can't stay on top of the weeds. We've totally stopped all of our spray crews for weeds. There's no fertilization programs. And then when you get to the community center and pool side, we've gradually rolled back the opening of our pools. We have 12 pools. Only six were open last summer, and five waiting pools were open. And we were faced going forward this year with, we're looking at none of our pools being open, but we do have possible good news there that we'll be announcing in on the 14th of this month.
Can you give us a preview of what that good news is?
Well, we have a sponsor who has come in a fairly large way, and that'll be rolled out in a public announcement and a large media event on the 14th.
Okay.
So it's looking good for the pools, but that's a one-year deal. Then we're right back where we were before. This is not a long-term fix. So the long-term fix is this economy recovering and us coming out of the economy. Mm-hmm. Last year, as Cecily mentioned, we were faced with the council literally cutting back the operations of most of our community centers, including Clooney, including Oak Park. And Michael is here today from the Oak Park community. And we were faced, they literally told me at the council meeting, this is unacceptable. We want you to keep the community centers open, but we're not going to give you any money. So the challenge was to get out there and find community groups and organizations that would take over the operation of these facilities. Now, they did come through a couple of months later and give me some operational funds to help out, but it's very severe.
And how many parks and community centers are we talking about?
We have over 200 parks, about 14 community centers. We have 12 pools and 5 freestanding waiting pools.
And how many employees now? You said you're down 50%?
Yes.
How many employees do you have in the whole department?
Well, about 65% of our department right now is off the general fund through grant funding and state funds and so forth. So counting all of that together, we have over 600 employees still. We still are a large department. And we still have a large amount of programs. They're just not as extensive as they were. For example, we're still running community centers, but not in the way we did before. Okay. We're still operating pools, but not full operations.
I'm speaking with Jim Coombs of
Coombs
of the Sacramento Department of Parks and Rec. Also here are Cecily Hastings and Lisa Schmidt from the Friends of East Sacramento, who have managed to pull together a group of people and some money and some processes to keep McKinley open. And also here is Michael Boyd from the Oak Park Neighborhood Association. And you are you've been talking with Cecily and Lisa and Jim, I'm assuming, to figure out ways in order to keep some of your community centers open. Which centers are you particularly focused on in Oak Park?
We only have one, the Oak Park Community Center on Martin Luther King Boulevard. So that's what we're focusing on. We've been speaking with Lisa, Cecily, anyone who has any good ideas, we want to hear them. Mm-hmm. We're looking at Sierra 2 in Curtis Park as a model that's been around for a long time.
Right.
See how we can emulate and learn from them.
Yeah, in fact, let's. I want to talk about Oak Park, but let's also talk about CR2 because I don't think a lot of people realize it was originally a school.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then the school was decommissioned.
Yes.
And the neighbors drew together and turned it into a community center.
More than 35 years ago.
Yes, it's and that was a case where the neighborhood association took the lead on that. There was a little bit different situation because it was from what we've and we. Talked to that we actually went over and spent quite a bit of time over there, and their director of Sierra 2 is on our advisory team. That their that school, the condition they got it in was pretty good. It what the school had maintained it, the school district had maintained it right up until the end, and so that they did not have a lot of restoration to do to that historic building. That we're now facing with Clooney. So that made it a little bit easier, but the facility's almost 10 times larger.
Right.
That's why we knew that if it could work on that scale and we took the sort of best practices that they used in the managing of that center and applied them to Clooney, that without even that type of organization, Sierra Curtis Neighborhood Association is very strong and very broad in terms of their membership and skills and everything. That's why we realized that on a much smaller scale that Lisa and I could oversee this.
Getting back to Oak Park, Michael Boyd, you're trying to save the community center. Is it open at all now?
Or it is open about 2.5 days a week now. And our goal is to make sure we open up a full-time schedule again.
And what does what function does the community center serve in your neighborhood, especially since it's the only one?
Well, you can imagine what a community center does function as. It has a kitchen area. It has rooms for rent. It has conference rooms. It has a new basketball court, indoor basketball court, all of which are now being underutilized. And we know there's a demand for them.
When you say they're being underutilized, but there's a demand for them, they're underutilized in the sense that they aren't open?
They're simply not open. Oak Park Neighborhood Association used to meet at the community center, and now we can't because they're not open on Thursday night when we meet.
And so when it is open, it's still being used pretty substantially?
From what I hear, yes.
And so what are you finding out from Lisa and Cecily in terms of, and from Jim, in terms of what you can do in order to make this work? Because Oak Park has a very different economic base than a neighborhood like East Sacramento does.
It does, but that can also be used as an asset in a way. I think no one wants to see a community center in a great neighborhood like Oak Park close. And mm-hmm. so we will get a lot of support. Our goal right now as a neighborhood association is simply to keep the doors open. Then we'll outreach to the entire community and say, now what does this community center mean for us? How do we make this center work for all of the people here? Mm-hmm. We'll design programs around that. And there are ways of doing that. Because we're Oak Park and we have a reputation for being very active, Oak Park Neighborhood Association, by many measures, is one of the most active and best attended neighborhood associations in the entire country. Hmm. We get 75 to 100 members come to every meeting every month.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot.
Anyone who's been to a community center neighborhood meetings knows that's a lot of people.
So we have a lot of
assets.
We
don't have that in East Sacramento. Yeah. It's very difficult to get more than 20 people to a meeting on even a very contentious issue. The level of activity and involvement in Oak Park is quite astounding compared to East Sacramento.
So our resources are different, but we have great resources in Oak Park. And we're being a little creative in different ways. We're talking with different schools, including Sac State, to see if we can come up with an internship program that would benefit both the students and community center and the community. So there are ways we can leverage our what are considered weaknesses and convert them into assets.
Jim, how do you look at a neighborhood like Oak Park versus East Sac, because Oak Park has such limited resources, when you're having to go, I'm assuming that you have the discretion to go around and decide which things get open and closed as a director?
Well, I don't have full discretion, but the challenge for us is we do have a diversity of neighborhoods. And every neighborhood has different abilities to offer volunteer services, money, economics, whatever it is. So the challenge for us is going in and identifying folks that are interested in the neighborhood, that are interested in working with us, organizations. Mm-hmm. And literally, we're working different arrangements and putting together different agreements with every single neighborhood. This is not a cookie-cutter approach, so it's taking a lot of time, a lot of dialogue. What we're doing in Oak Park is a different model than what we've done with Clooney, for example. Mm-hmm. We have another center, Robertson, that we placed a charter school in there, and they're also running public programs and a farmer's market and keeping the facility open to the public. So each one of our community centers, which when they're operating the way they should operate, are the hubs of neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it is pretty much in any community that you go in, any city. They become the gathering place. It's the hub of the neighborhood. So it's terrible what's happened to the community centers here. And we just try to go and find the energy wherever it's at and make that work for the centers.
Cecily Hastings, you in the article I referenced that you wrote, you spoke quite a bit about the financing and taking over a lot of these operations, because a lot of these community centers are actually run out of I don't want to say profit centers, but they actually produce income, which helps run the neighborhood centers. What did you do in East Sac to help replace some of that money? And what are we talking about in terms of the amount of money that the center was actually bringing in, as well as how much is it costing?
We went back 3 years and looked at the rental revenues that had come in for the past 3 years, and it had been higher in the past. And as all the talk of the closures of the neighborhood, and that was a difficult part for us, was trying to figure out what we can expect our first year. And we had to really, it's going to be substantially less than what it was last year in terms of rental revenue, because they've already cut back the hours. A lot of groups have already moved, and we're going to have to rebuild. And but the thing is that we're taking a really kind of I'm from the small business background, and we're taking a small business entrepreneurial approach to this, and having an on-site manager and the ability to just make quick decisions. I mean, if something doesn't work, we're thinking of having a store in there to sell. There's a lot of kids that come after school and parents that bring their kids. We're thinking of having maybe not a coffee, an espresso bar, but maybe just a coffee shop, and bring in a neighborhood bakery and sell things like that. And you know, frankly, we can do that for 60 days. And if it works out, great. If it doesn't, we close up and we find another idea to use the space. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're not going to be mired in having to get a lot of approvals and deal with a big organization. We can just use the skills and resources that we have to try to make this work. And I think that's what it's going to take to do that. Mm-hmm. But we're going to, you know, we're going to definitely be in a rebuilding mode for a year. And that was the focus of our fundraising, because when we looked at this originally, we thought it could kind of break even the first year. But as we got into more detail, and the other difficult part for us is that the city doesn't keep its records and its bookkeeping like a business does. Mm-hmm. You know, we started asking a lot of questions, and poor Jim probably got my emails and thought, oh no, here she comes again. She wants some more detail, you know, and it would take a long time to get it. And you know, because it's just not like, you know, in our case, it's going to be, Lisa's going to look up in a spreadsheet 6 months from now, and she can tell you exactly in uh-huh. 5 minutes what the situation is. Uh-huh. But we're dealing with a whole different ballgame with a big parks department. So that part was difficult, getting information. But as we realized when we got information and we started looking at the future, that we were going to have a substantial loss the first year. And that's where we had to make people, our team of advisors looked at it and said, you don't have enough money to take on this venture. And, you know, we're already a volunteered at least 500 hours between the two of us in the last 6 months. We don't want to go in the hole financially. We're not going to do that. So that's when we identified a goal, $45,000 that we needed for the first year. And then we identified a plan to get there, which was we're having corporate. Small, it's sort of corporations, but they're mostly a lot of small and large businesses. We're asked to, we have banners out in front that, mm-hmm. That as you walk up to Clooney, we'll have the names of the businesses, and they're very tasteful, and you know that they're involved in saving Clooney Center, and it's for 1 year. The banners will be up, and that actually helped us generate most of the what we need. Okay. We're still raising money for the restoration of the building. That is still an ongoing campaign that we're doing.
Okay. Well, as you said, it's a whole new ball game, and we're going to have to leave it there. But Cecily Hastings, Lisa Schmidt, Michael Boyd, Jim Combs, thank you all for coming in, and good luck. And good luck, Michael, with your process in Oak Park.
Well, thank you for having us, and thank you for the good words.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, nutrition in schools. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight is also online. You'll find a full archive of our past shows, along with podcasts, multimedia content, and other goodies on our website, capradio.org/insight. We want to hear from you. Tell us what you think of the show, suggest topic ideas, or just say hi. Go to our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio, or send us an email at insight@capradio.org. For the first time in 15 years, the federal government has overhauled school nutrition standards. The new standards require more fruits and vegetables, more whole grains, and for all milk to be 1% or less. But many schools in Northern California already meet and even exceed the standards. With me this morning is Carol Chase, Nutrition Education Administrator with the California Department of Education. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here today.
So it's nice to hear that we have standards that we exceed already. They've already put the new standards out, and some of the schools already exceed them, huh?
Yes. You know, it's and what I'm happy about is one of our schools that is meeting the standards well is here today with me. And, you know, there's been a number of things in California that have happened to make California in the position it is today. And I can name a couple of them if you'd like.
Sure.
Well, first of all, we have a program that is called SHAPE, which is Shaping Health as Partners in Education, and started in the early 90s. And Brenda Padilla, who's here at Sac City, is one of the schools that is following that program. And we have about 20% of our districts in California that meet that program. And that, like I said, started in the early 90s. In addition, we've had some key state legislation that has helped our schools get ready. And specifically, I think everybody heard about how California schools got the soda out. Right. And while it might have been a little bumpy, it really helped our schools position themselves to be providing healthier beverages. Well, in addition, there were some standards that improved actually the foods that were served. And specifically, we often talk about those other foods that are offered or sold in addition to the school meals. Well, by making those foods more healthy, it actually resulted in the school meal participation increasing. And, you know, lastly, I just want to mention that through the First Lady's Let's Move campaign, the Healthier U.S. School Challenge has also positioned a number of schools to be ready.
And this is a case, though, in as in a lot of things, where the rest of the nation is sort of following California's lead, right?
Which well,
is
I why like we're to in believe the, that.
Yes. Why there's not quite as much adjustment as there might otherwise be.
Well, I, you know, definitely California has always been a leader in nutrition, and it's got to do with not just our Department of Education, but public health and also all the advocates that help to push the changes.
Mm-hmm. Also with me here is Brenda Padilla, who is manager of nutrition services for the Sacramento City Unified School District. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
So you're on the ground there. You're looking at the food every day.
That's correct.
And what in these new standards in your district will change?
Well, first of all, I want to say that while, as Carol mentioned, we, you know, California operators have been leading the way, but this change comes with an additional meal reimbursement. And we really applaud Congress and USDA for making that change.
What is
it's 6 cents additional meal reimbursement. And while we hope, you know, they continue to make those kinds of investments, it is going to help operators, you know, find the funding that we've all been saying for years that we need mm-hmm. more of. So,
but what is it? What is a reimbursement? I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, the meal program, we basically do our job, and then we get reimbursed for each meal that we serve to students.
By the federal government.
Correct.
And it, you say 6 cents?
It's an additional 6 cents, and it's, while a small investment, it is an investment, and we hope they continue to make those kind of investments in the program.
Will you multiply it by how many lunches do you serve in the course of a month, say?
A day, about 30,000.
In a day, mm-hmm. about 30,000. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, we can do the math on that one. That's a lot of lunches, and 6 cents would add up.
It's going to help. And people have long been saying you get what you pay for. And we know that this will go a ways to help us improve the nutritional qualities and meet the standards. As Carol stated, Sacramento City Unified has been upfront in working towards meeting the standards. We've been a SHAPE nutrient standard menu planning district for many years in our K-6 mm-hmm. and K-8, but that's on paper. You know, what you really see in the meal program is salad bars in every school, choices of fresh fruits and vegetables, our partnership with our local farmers to bring their fruits and vegetables into our salad bars and into our lunch program specifically. We're already meeting the milk requirements for several years now. Mm-hmm. We're meeting the whole grain requirements currently, and we'll be on target to meet the 100% whole grains per the guidelines, and we'll meet that.
Oh, it's going to go up because now it's 51%.
Correct. It's half of your whole grains offered need to be whole.
Which is a big deal because sandwiches, pizza, mm-hmm. right? And pizza is a huge school lunch thing still, mm-hmm. which is sort of for better or for worse, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, for better in Sac City Unified is that our K-6, we're making our own French bread pizza. So we have a local purveyor who's making our whole grain roll that we put that on. And so that meets it. And we're able to control how much, you know, cheese and fat that we put on it to keep it low and meet the requirements. So that's one of the steps in the direction that we're going to continue.
That's Brenda Padilla. She is manager of nutrition services for Sacramento City Unified School District. Also with me is Carol Chase, nutrition education administrator with the California Department of Education. And on the phone, we have Shelly Giannata from Lake Tahoe Unified School District. She is the food manager there. Are you there, Shelly?
Yes, I am. And I wanted to thank you for having me on the show today. It's
my
quite
pleasure.
An honor to be on the show with distinguished companies such as Carol and Brenda.
Well, I wanted to ask you because one of the parent nightmares of raising children is trying to get them to eat their fruits and vegetables. How do you do that in a school district?
Lots of patience. we try, if a child just absolutely refuses to eat something, we'll try to encourage them to try a little tiny sample of it. You know, we kind of have a three-time rule. If we put something new on the menu, be it a fruit or a vegetable or even an entree, we try to serve it at least three times. If it fails after three times, we might want to rethink that particular item we've tried to serve. So,
and what are some of the item? What are some of the fruit and vegetable, particularly vegetable items that you serve in order to that kids like?
Well, they like steamed broccoli, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. They like fresh salads, tossed salads. You know, with either like a light Italian dressing or a light ranch dressing. They love carrot sticks and celery sticks. Anything they can dip. Kids love to dip things. Mm-hmm.
Preferably in peanut butter or...
we try to be... Peanut butter's kind of a scary thing. We've got the allergy concerns out there.
Oh,
we use
right.
a lot of sunflower butter, you know, made from sunflower seeds. So that's a nice product that we actually started just getting in this year.
Mm-hmm. Is there a... Brenda, are there factors in terms of, you know, the general population's eating patterns have changed quite a bit over the last, even the last 15 years before the last standards. Do you find that you have a lot of students who have special needs in terms of food or, you know, I mean, now people are gluten intolerant. There's so many other allergies. How do you manage that?
Right. We have about 46,000 students in our district. So, yes, we do come, you know, those children come to us with special dietary needs and we do accommodate them. And what we try to do in Sac City Unified is offer them the foods that we serve other children and then just change it up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a gluten, they need, instead of, you know, wheat, they'll get a rice product. Or we try to make it as normal of a meal as the other children are getting.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as the fruits and vegetables, you know, it's choices, and kids love to make their own choices. So our district, our superintendent Raymond started the Healthy Foods Task Force, and part of that was to bring the salad bars into every school, and we offer a variety of, you know, things that choices that we hope every student will be able to make a choice if they like kiwi or orange smiles, or if we can sneak some spinach into our salads. And they're accepting that, especially when they can go and make their own choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm afraid we're out of time, but thank you all for joining us today to talk about nutrition in the public schools. Carol Chase, Brenda Padilla, and Shelley Giannata, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Maggie Hollenbeck and Blue. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Now it's time to find out what's happening in the news today with senior editor Alan Ray. He joins us from the newsroom. Alan, what's up?
Well, earlier this year, David, West Connections announced it was leaving its first home in Folsom for a more business-friendly headquarters, it said, in Texas, and taking the jobs with it. Today, Sure West Communications of Roseville, which is where it started, announced it's been sold to a company called Consolidated Communications Holdings. No word on the job implications there. Those stories and more on NPR and All Things Considered this afternoon from Capital Public Radio beginning at 3:30.
All right. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
For the past few years, pianist and bandleader Graham Sobelman has produced Grammarama, an occasional series of cabaret-like shows featuring a wealth of Sacramento's singing talent doing all sorts of things in a small theater setting. Tomorrow night, Sobelman has produced an evening with local talent Maggie Hollenbeck, an actor and musician who is also a marriage and family therapist. Graham Sobelman, Maggie Hollenbeck, welcome to Insight.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Maggie, you are doing you're doing Blue, the entire Joni Mitchell album.
We are.
What inspired that?
We've been talking about Joni for a long time. It was one of the first things that Graham and I connected about. And I'm a singer, songwriter, and of course Joni has been a huge influence on me and has been an influence for Graham too. So we've been talking about doing a Joni Mitchell show for a long time. And honestly, probably a lot of things contributed to it, but when I went through the songs that I would want to sing for a Joni Mitchell cabaret, pretty much every song from Blue always showed up on my list. And I thought, well, let's just do the album then. I mean, it's such an iconic album, and it's really one of the most perfect albums ever recorded. So let's pay tribute to it, you know?
It's also one of the most intimate, personal albums ever recorded,
yeah.
Which would make it an interesting challenge for you. You're also an actor. How much of that comes into play in this particular show of doing that album? Because you're not Joni Mitchell, and those were songs that she wrote very much about her life at a very sort of raw moment. So how do you do that?
Well, there's something about that always resonated with me. Music that is intimate and lays you bare. That's the kind of music that I really, really love. And I love to write that kind of music, and I love to sing that kind of music. And I think that I resonate pretty deeply with a lot of this music. And so I tell the story from my own heart, you mm-hmm. know, because it's because I can find those places in my own story and in my own heart. So that's where I'm coming from with these stories. There's a lot of resonance for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And are you doing the album in sequence, the way the album was released? Graham Sobelman,
yep.
You want to answer that question?
Mostly, yes. We maybe toyed around with a little bit at the very end, but that was a little source of contention during rehearsals.
Way to ruin the surprise, Graham.
Yeah, but for the most part, yes.
Yes.
And talking about Grammarama, because how long have you been doing this? 4 or 5 years now?
This is like our fourth season starting right now.
Okay.
So, yeah, we've been 3 years.
And this is the big, this is the first night of the season.
Yeah, we started February of 2009, so this is like exactly 4 years later.
And how many shows a year do you do?
I had started, we did 42 the first year.
I was going to say, it was every week.
And I'm actually playing the show at the Cosmopolitan right now, 7 shows a week. So I decided for now I'm just going to do a monthly show over at that space.
Oh, okay.
So we've changed locations. We were doing it at the Geary before and now at the Cosmo. And we're going to try this out, just a monthly show, and maybe spend a little more time putting it together.
Uh-huh. Because that's a much larger theater. I think that's, what, five times as many people?
Yeah, it's 200 seats over there.
And the Geary's 50.
50, yeah.
Yeah, so that's quite a bit bigger. Mm-hmm. And you've also, one difference between, my familiar with Grammarama is that it's multiple performers.
We've done every sort of combination, but yeah, we do a lot of times where we have a whole bunch of people show up. Sometimes we've only done we've done one or two singers,
mm-hmm.
But this is we're gonna feature Maggie. We actually have an opening act with some other performers also.
Oh, who?
Nancy Zoppi, okay. And Hannah Kyle, a friend of ours from Auburn.
Okay, and Nancy Zoppi is familiar to anybody who's been. She's been in many, many Grammaramas,
exactly.
Right?
Yes, the very first one, actually, too, yeah.
A fantastic singer, and she's going to be opening this
yeah.
show.
So, yeah, Hannah and Nancy are going to do some songs, and then we'll take an intermission, and then we'll do Blue.
Well, speaking of doing some songs, you performed a song earlier that we're going to play now. You want to introduce it?
Sure. This is a song called Little Green from the Blue album, and one of my recent favorites, actually. I didn't fully appreciate it until recently, and the story of the song didn't come out for many, many years after the album was recorded. It's about it was sort of a secret that Joni put on the album, but it was about the child that she had very young and had to put up for adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a gorgeous song that I have only recently come to really appreciate. The depth in the lyrics.
All right. Well, this is Maggie Hollenbeck doing Joni Mitchell's Little Green.
He's lost to you, little green. He He's a nonconformer, just a little green, like the color when the spring is born. There'll be crocuses to bring to school tomorrow, just a little green, like the nights when the northern lights perform. There'll be icicles and birthday clothes, and sometimes there'll be sorrow. Child with a child pretending, weary of lies you are sending home. So you sign all the papers in the family name. You're sad and you're sorry, but you're not ashamed. Little green, have a happy ending. Just a little green, like the color when the spring is born. There'll be crocuses to bring to school tomorrow. Just a little green, like the nights when the northern lights perform. There'll be icicles and birthday clothes, and sometimes there'll be sorrow.
Beautiful. Maggie Hollenbeck doing Joni Mitchell's Little Green.
Thanks.
You and were you playing guitar as well?
I was, yeah. Yeah.
And you will be playing, Graham Sobel will be playing
piano yeah.
during the show as well, because yeah. she played piano and guitar on the mm-hmm. album.
Yeah, and there's also three other guys playing in the band. So we have a drummer, bass player, and another guitar player.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. So you expanded it musically then a little bit. Because the original album, I think there's a little bass on there. Stephen Stills played a little bass, and mm-hmm. there's just a couple, but very very little besides just
We sort of played around. We sort of went off the song list or the order as a basic starting point, and then we sort of talked through things and thought, well, that might be kind of fun to play around with experimenting on the sound. And so some of the
We talked quite a lot, actually, about how much we wanted to be true to the album versus how much we wanted to really, you know, bring our own mm-hmm. sound to it or mm-hmm. you know, or find our own ways to play it. And that evolved over time. And as soon as we got the band in,
it changed even more.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Although it's interesting because you you did a really, really good job. I mean, I just listening to you do it, you can hear the places where it would be so easy to go wrong by going off where she was, because you sing it very much how she does, but it still doesn't sound like her, which is kind of a neat trick. I mean, it's hard to imagine how you would do that exactly.
You know, I know the album so well. I've listened to it. I mean, I really know it backwards and forwards, you know, because it was such an influential album for me. But when we started working on this Cabaret, we both decided to stop listening to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, good call, yeah.
And so then it has had to evolve into our own sound.
Well, everybody's going to get a chance to hear it tomorrow night at the Cosmopolitan Cabaret. Maggie Hollenbeck, Graham Sobelman, good luck with this year's Grammarama.
Thanks
for having us.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Rio Americano High School in Sacramento County has a long history of producing outstanding musicians and has won all manner of awards and competitions through the years. Various editions of the group have been 7-time winner at the Monterey Jazz Festival's Next Generation Competition, 5-time finalist at the Essentially Ellington Competition and Festival, and this year a group of Rio Americano students have been selected to compete in the Charles Mingus Festival in New York City in 3 weeks. They are one of only 12 groups nationwide and the only one west of the Mississippi ever to have been selected. And we now have a few of them in our studio. And they are led by Max Keisner from Rio Americano High School. He's the band director there. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having us.
And we also have here Paul. What's your give us your last name as well? Sorry.
My name is Paul Slater.
Paul Slater, and what do you play?
I play drums.
Okay.
My name is Joey Coz. I play piano.
Nick De La O. I play bass.
All right. And how big is the total band?
The total band is 8 members for this combo that we're taking to New York.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. You've been director at Rio Americano for 5 years?
That's right. Yeah. After college in 2007, I came out here and started teaching.
Okay. And you really inherited, I mean, this goes back a long time. I remember hearing about Rio Americano bands in the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. A long time. It's been established since the 80s. Like you said, the former director, Craig Fagnani, had established the program and really raised it to quite a significant level. He has since moved on and is now our VAPA coordinator within the district. And Josh Murray, the director who's there teaching with me, has been there since 97, I believe, 96. And it's just, trying to keep the ball rolling. So,
and why is Rio Americano so, why do these programs just keep on going and keep producing such good students?
Well, you know, it's the students themselves. It's the parents, and it's kind of this family atmosphere that we have. I mean, the guys we have in the studio and all the students we have in our program are our best friends, and it just feels like it's a warm community, you know. So when you step in the classroom, you feel comfortable. You feel like you're part of a larger thing, something larger than yourself. And that was evident from the first day I got there. It was just, you know, people were laughing, joking around, you know, giving each other hugs, singing happy birthday to one another. And it's just it's a great atmosphere to be part of. So,
well, let's listen to a little bit of the music that atmosphere has produced. We have a little clip here from a recording that you guys did. That's the Rio Americano Jazz Band, or is that a small jazz combo? What's the name of the?
Yes, that was the recording of this group, the Rio Americano Jazz Combo.
Jazz Combo, okay. Mm-hmm. And there's a larger jazz band. I'm assuming there's several different groups.
There are several. We have 4 jazz ensembles. We've got the AM Jazz Ensemble and the PM Jazz Ensemble. Those are the top 2 0 period ensembles. And we also have 2 freshman jazz ensembles, one called the FM Jazz Ensemble and the Jazz Workshop class.
And the 3 of you musicians who are here right now, you're all on that recording?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And what year are you guys?
I'm a senior.
Mm-hmm. I'm a sophomore.
And I'm a junior.
Okay. Also on the recording was Michael Wang, who wasn't able to be here today because he's rehearsing to be in the Grammy Orchestra.
That's right.
<Yep. laughs> On Sunday night.
That's right. We just received a message from this morning that he is performing with Esperanza Spalding. Mm-hmm. And who else was it, guys?
Paul McCartney, I think.
Paul McCartney,
he's
a few other folks.
No kidding.
Opening for the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra.
Yeah pretty so, heavy stuff, so yeah. He's enjoying himself down there, I'm sure.
Wow. So you guys are all very much on the national radar then.
Absolutely. These kids, you know, played a very, very high level, and the program is been known throughout the country due to competitions like the Charles Mingus competition and the Central Ellington competition. Mm-hmm. And our kids are just known for having a lot of fun and playing music.
Tell me a little bit more about the Charles Mingus competition. That's in 3 weeks from the weekend?
Yeah, it'll be February 17th, and we're staying there until the 21st, so we're going to spend about 4 or 5 days in New York. And that was started about 4 years ago by Sue Mingus, and it's run by this organization called...
Charles Widow.
Yes, exactly right, exactly right. And she has this organization called Let the Children Hear Music Incorporated, and this group has put on the festival for 4 years, and we decided to apply to it about 3 years ago, and we were fortunate enough to be let in all 3 years that we applied. And it's filled with clinics and concerts by members of the Mingus Orchestra and some of the best players in New York City.
Now, Mingus was known as a composer, and interestingly enough, we had Maggie Hollenbeck on singing Joni Mitchell. Joni Mitchell made an album with Charles Mingus.
That's right.
There's also Henry Robinette, who's a guitar player here in town, is the nephew of Charles Mingus.
That's right.
What is it about Mingus, and are you playing Mingus music? Because that's pretty big time stuff, right?
Yeah, we're playing an all Mingus set for Mingus, and we just basically create a set of a list of Mingus tunes that they give us, and we prepare them as best as we can.
Mm-hmm. And what's that like? As you're a drummer, no, you're a bass player, Nick. Mm-hmm. And Mingus was a bass player.
Yes.
So what's that like for you?
It's a little intimidating. Luckily, a lot of people overlook the fact that he was also an incredible bass player and only focus on his compositions. So I get to sneak a little under the radar for that.
Pressure's off because it's on the whole ensemble because of the recording. How do you, Max, how do you guys choose Mingus tracks to do?
Well, I basically just pass the tunes on to them, and they kind of, they do all the work themselves, really. They kind of know their strengths. I mean, these kids are aware of what they can do and what they can't do, so they kind of sit down together as a group and decide, all right, what tunes can we do? What do we know as a group? And what do you think we're going to sound good playing? And I think they've done a really good job choosing literature this year, as they always do. We've got a number of arrangers and composers in the groups ourselves, so they take these tunes and they don't play them, you know, down as we've heard them before. They make their own creative arrangements or put their own personal touches on these tracks.
Some of the students,
absolutely,
in the band.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you guys, I'm curious how long you guys have been playing. Nick, how long have you been playing?
I've been playing since about sixth grade, I think.
And I started playing piano when I was about 5 years old, and I started jazz about 3 years ago.
Wow, just 3 years, and you've come this far. That's amazing.
Quick. Yeah.
And Paul?
Well, I've been playing drums since about second or third grade, and then I started playing jazz, like mainly jazz, in about eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And usually people your age are generally not so interested in jazz, probably. You're more probably into different rock or hip-hop or whatever. How's that with other music for you guys?
I mean, we all really listen. We listen to all types of music, you know. Our program really stresses listening to all sorts of music, mm-hmm. and being mm-hmm. being really spongy about your playing, you know, absorbing everything you listen to and just being open to all types of music.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to leave it there, but that's Joey Caza, from piano player, Nick De La O on bass, and Paul Slater on drums, and Max Kiesner, leader of the band. And do you play?
I do. I'm a trumpet player as well. Yeah.
Okay. Do you play? You don't play with the band, though?
No, not with these kids.
That
no,
would be
they've
cheating.
Got their own. That would be cheating. I don't know how they'd see that.
All right, well, thanks so much. Are you guys going to be playing anywhere before this trip?
Oh, we've got tons of concerts at school at Rio Americano, and many of these guys are also involved in this SF Shadow Collective, so they have some performances coming up pretty soon, actually, right after the festival. Mm-hmm. So you can always check us out at rioband.net, or just give us a call, and we'll let you know.
All right. And you can actually check you out right now, because we're going to play a little bit more of your music going out.
All right. Thanks for having us.
All right. Thanks for coming in. And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight's assistant producers are James Morrison and Lynn Weaver. Today's associate producers were Sarah Jung and Sasa Morar. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us.